Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Taking Control of Anxiety: Small Steps for Getting the Best of Worry, Stress, and Fear by Brett A. Moore. Read by Kyle Tate. Anxiety, an Introduction. Anxiety is the dizziness of freedom. Soren Kierkegaard. Late one Saturday night, after a concert, Lori began to feel uneasy while walking to her car in the parking garage. She started thinking about her friend who was assaulted a few weeks back. She began to walk faster. Her heart began racing. She broke into a sweat. She felt like she couldn't catch her breath, and her chest was tight. She just knew she was in trouble, and that something bad was about to happen. After reaching her car, she jumped in and locked the doors. But she could not drive. Her hands were trembling, and she felt dizzy. After 5 minutes or so, she felt better, and was able to drive home. For several days afterward, all she could think about was how terrified she'd felt that night. David was an A student and a highly acclaimed athlete in high school. Things always came easily for him. It wasn't until he failed a midterm exam during his second semester in college that he started doubting his abilities. He began worrying about future tests, wondering whether he would fail them as well. Although he didn't fail any other exams, his worry about the possibility of failing made it difficult for him to study. This caused his grades to drop from A's to B's and C's. Things got worse. He began worrying about his future, particularly his career. If he was only an average student, or worse, flunked out of college, he'd never get a good job. Without a good job, no woman would ever want to marry him. David believed he was destined for a life of disappointment and unhappiness. Marie hit a rough patch in her life. Not only did she lose her job in a tough economy, her boyfriend of 3 years left her for another woman. If that wasn't enough, her elderly mother was hospitalized after falling and breaking her hip, which left her ailing father at home to care for himself. Marie's only sibling, an older brother, was of no help, as he had cut off all ties from his parents after leaving home. Consequently, the responsibility of caring for her parents fell squarely on her shoulders. Marie thought, "Why is it one thing after the other? My boyfriend left me, my parents are sick, and I don't know how I'm going to pay next month's rent. It's just too much for me to handle." If you are like most people, you can identify with the stories of Lori, David, and Marie to some degree. Perhaps you can identify with more than one of them. They are average people who, for varied reasons, are confronted with anxiety. Anxiety is as much of the current American culture as are reality television, online shopping, and cell phones. It is interwoven into our collective psyche so much that we spend billions of dollars each year trying to understand it, minimize its impact on our daily lives, or get rid of it completely. We worry about our careers. We stress about meeting next month's mortgage or rent. We obsess over the neatness of our homes. And we stay up late at night wondering whether we've forgotten something we should have done today or should do tomorrow. We can't help ourselves. It's just part of who we are. But the good news is that anxiety doesn't have to control you. With a bit of knowledge, awareness, and a few simple techniques, you can effectively control your anxiety. Notice that I said control. Controlling your anxiety is a reasonable goal. Ridding yourself of anxiety is not. If your goal is to rid yourself of anxiety, you are setting yourself up for failure. Anxiety is part of the human experience. In fact, you wouldn't want to completely rid yourself of it if you could. Anxiety, in its various forms, is adaptive and serves critical functions, as I discuss next. The key is how you manage your anxiety through self-regulation, understanding, and acceptance. Trying to eliminate anxiety from your daily experience will leave you feeling frustrated and defeated. What is anxiety? worry, stress, tension, nervousness, panic, fear, unease, jitters, angst, and the ever-popular heebie-jeebies are all used to describe anxiety. However, these terms are not completely interchangeable. Although definitions vary in their complexity, anxiety is generally viewed as an unpleasant feeling of apprehension, concern, or dread. It's a palpable feeling of unease and unrest, and is often cryptic in its cause, difficult to describe, and a challenge to ignore. There are three terms, however, that share similarities and are most often used to describe anxiety: worry, fear, and stress. Worry is what we do to ourselves by thinking too much. Worry in itself is not a big deal. It's unlikely a day goes by that you don't worry about something. But, as is clear in David's story, worry can become problematic if it starts to infiltrate many areas of your life. More important, if it causes you emotional, work or school or relationship problems, it's time to do something about it. Again, worrying about bills or your child from time to time is generally of little concern. Worrying about many things all the time is more problematic. Fear, the most primitive form of anxiety, is the emotional response to a known or suspected threat. It often shows itself through panic, as described in the vignette of Lori. Fear is considered to be a primitive emotion because it has served an important function in the evolution of humans. In fact, it continues to serve an important function in modern society, although for slightly different reasons. As discussed in later chapters, fear and panic are warning systems that help people make quick and important decisions about their safety and the safety of others. In some cases, in the absence of a real threat, people's warning systems malfunction, leaving them feeling embarrassed and emotionally and physically drained. Stress, a term that is used to describe just about everything psychologically and physically unpleasant, is what the body and mind experience when life's demands are greater than what people feel they can handle or should be required to endure. If you don't believe me, over the next few days, listen to how many times you hear someone say they are stressed about work, school, parenthood, finances, health, marriage, friendships, traffic, chores, and so on. It has become a catch-all term in today's culture. It's a hodgepodge of the various forms of anxiety, fatigue, exhaustion, emotional and physical pain, and a few other ingredients thrown in for good measure. But it remains in the anxiety family. So, if I've lost you with my various descriptions and definitions of anxiety, don't worry. Throughout the book, I use the term anxiety to describe worry, stress, fear, panic, and the like. The techniques I describe work for them all. However, if nuance is needed to understand a certain point, I let you know. The key point to remember is that anxiety is a complex emotional and physical phenomenon that takes different forms for different people. And most important, you are not powerless against it. The good and the bad of anxiety. At times, anxiety gets an undeserved bad rap. Just like alcohol, fast food, and slot machines, most everything is harmless in moderation. Anxiety is no different. Actually, some anxiety can be helpful. Not unlike Goldilocks' appreciation for perfectly warmed porridge. A just right amount of anxiety can bring about contentment. It also improves physical and mental performance, counters fatigue, and motivates people to do things they would otherwise avoid. Through its various physical manifestations, anxiety plays an important role in communication. It can let someone know that we feel uncomfortable, nervous, or even afraid. Without saying a word, it can communicate, "I need some space," or "I'm not comfortable with what you are saying or doing." This may be particularly true, and helpful, for members of some cultural groups that are less comfortable vocalizing concerns or emotions to people outside their close social network. Anxiety can also communicate interest and attraction to another person. A man whose voice trembles every time he's around an attractive woman, or a teenage girl who giggles, avoids eye contact, and blushes in the presence of a potential prom date are prime examples. The problem is that it's difficult to define what that right amount of anxiety is. The amount that's optimal for you may cause someone else to shut down. Regardless, anxiety is a good thing if you can find the right balance. So, when is anxiety considered a problem? It depends. As I mentioned earlier, anxiety is a part of our culture. If you don't experience at least a mild degree of anxiety, then you should probably be anxious about why you aren't experiencing any. However, a general rule of thumb is that if anxiety causes persistent and serious disruption in major areas of your life, family, work, social relationships, then it is likely a problem. So, what is serious disruption? It depends on the person. We all react differently to different types and levels of stress and anxiety. For example, if a teacher is worried about whether her students will meet the school's performance standards next month and experiences a few nights of insomnia as a result, then this will likely be seen as more of a temporary nuisance. However, if this same teacher experiences continuous sleep problems, which leads to her being written up for coming in late to work, or if she experiences an increase in irritability, which leads to increased fighting between her and her husband, then this likely needs to be addressed. It doesn't mean that she is pathological, sick, or crazy. It could just mean that she needs a little extra help dealing with life's normal struggles. This help could include talking with a counselor, friend, family member, or religious or spiritual leader, going for a walk several times each week, or reading a self-help book such as this one. How big is the problem? Now that you know that day-to-day anxiety affects almost everyone, you may be wondering how many of us go on to develop a full-blown psychiatric disorder. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, approximately 18% of American adults have experienced an anxiety disorder over the past year. This translates to around 40 million people who are impacted to the point where professional intervention may be warranted. Out of those 40 million, only around 15 million actually seek treatment. This means that the vast majority of people manage their anxiety without the help of psychotherapy or medication. This can be good news or bad news, depending on how you look at it. The cynic would say that there are millions of highly distressed people walking around who need help. The optimist would likely argue that people are highly resilient and can manage even high levels of distress with their own personal resources. I tend to believe that it's more of the latter. Most of us, whether or not we know it, already use a variety of techniques to manage stress. This book will help you identify and refine those already existing techniques, as well as provide you with some additional ones. How is anxiety diagnosed? If you see a mental health professional for your anxiety, chances are you will be given a formal diagnosis, and maybe more than one. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM for short, is a publication by the American Psychiatric Association and is often referred to as the Psychiatric Bible. The latest version is the fifth edition, DSM-5. The DSM houses several different anxiety-related disorders and provides diagnostic labels and codes for each. Mental health professionals rely on these psychiatric labels for several reasons. First, and probably foremost, it allows healthcare providers to get paid. Insurance companies generally do not reimburse for mental health services unless a formal diagnosis is submitted. Second, diagnostic labels allow mental health professionals to communicate with each other. For example, if a person is seen by one doctor and transfers to another, a diagnosis, in theory, provides the new doctor general information about the person's mental health status. And last, Diagnoses help scientists conduct research on particular groups of people, or more appropriately, symptoms, which help determine which treatments are most effective for which disorders. I mention the DSM because I believe it's important that a person be aware of the practice of diagnosing by mental health professionals. There is a deep and wide debate about the validity, reliability, motivations, and ethics associated with the DSM, particularly the DSM-5. Some critics of the practice feel that it pathologizes, labels people as sick when they aren't, normal reactions to stress, and lumps people into narrow and poorly defined categories. Others believe the main purpose of the book is to promote psychiatry, a profession that relies primarily on the use of medications to treat psychiatric conditions. Indeed, there is tremendous financial incentive for the profession and pharmaceutical companies to elevate pharmacology as the premier option for treating mental health issues. As with most things in life, however, the truth likely resides somewhere in the middle. With all that being said, the most important thing to keep in mind is that your symptoms may look similar to someone else's, but the way you experience them is not the same as someone else might. Therefore, you shouldn't be viewed the same or treated the same. You are the expert of you, and you know what works best for you. Don't let anyone try to convince you otherwise. Refer to the list of major anxiety disorders for your reference. List of major anxiety disorders. Generalized anxiety disorder, GAD, is characterized by excessive and uncontrollable worry about everyday situations that is above and beyond what would be expected. People with GAD tend to worry about finances, health, family, work, the future, and myriad other things. Panic disorder involves recurring panic attacks, which are short periods of intense feelings of fear and apprehension, and a variety of physical symptoms, such as racing heart, sweating, and trembling. Generally, the symptoms come out of nowhere, and even though it may seem like some specific threat is looming, there isn't one. Agoraphobia is characterized by anxiety in situations where the person feels he or she can't escape. There is an intense fear that the person will lose it, freak out, or go crazy in public, and become trapped. Consequently, the person avoids going out in public. In extreme cases, the person may become homebound. Specific phobia is the excessive and highly distressing fear of specific objects or situations. The person avoids the objects or situations at all costs as a way to fend off the associated distress. Common examples include fear of flying, heights, snakes, spiders, and blood or needles. Obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD, is characterized by recurring intrusive and unremitting thoughts that produce discomfort, worry, or fear and/or compulsions. Handwashing, counting, checking, that are engaged in for the purpose of reducing discomfort. Attempts at controlling or suppressing the obsessions or compulsions are generally unsuccessful. Post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, develops after exposure to a traumatic event, such as rape, combat, or witnessing harm to another person. Symptoms include re-experiencing the trauma through nightmares, avoidance of reminders of the trauma, sleep disturbances, and being easily startled. Social phobia, also referred to as social anxiety disorder, is a persistent and excessive fear of situations that may involve scrutiny or judgment by others, such as parties and other social events. Generally, there is a strong fear by the person that he or she will be embarrassed in front of others. Where does anxiety come from, and why does it stay? Trying to find a single cause for your anxiety will leave you frustrated and dissatisfied. This is because anxiety is caused by many factors. There is no one gene, life experience, or neurochemical that explains anxiety. It is, however, primarily a combination of three things: biology, environment, and psychology. Biology. Anxiety is hardwired into humans' physiology, and for understandable reasons. As we trekked across our largely unexplored planet thousands of years ago, we did it alongside a variety of threats. We shared our space with hungry and vicious animals, inhospitable fellow humans, and climates that would stress even today's most prepared hikers. Without an internal warning system, early humans would have likely been faced with extinction. Luckily, the fight-or-flight system came to be. The fight-or-flight system is an extremely complex, highly sensitive, and intricately balanced biological process. Prompted by a cascade of chemicals and electrical impulses, our body prepares for one of two actions when faced by a perceived threat: defend against the threat, or run away. When this happens, a variety of adaptive processes occur. The heart pumps blood to the muscles faster, which provides the increased nutrients needed to duke it out or split. Our vision narrows to focus better on the threat so that we don't get distracted by unimportant stimuli around us. And breathing becomes deeper and more frequent to deliver increased oxygen to the system. Once the threat is gone, however, or at least when we believe it is gone, an opposite process occurs in which the body regains its balance. The fight-or-flight system has been encrypted into humans' genes and passed down from generation to generation. Unfortunately, the system's biological software has not been updated for the modern world. For some people, the alarm goes off in the absence of a real threat. For example, seeing a snake behind the glass at the zoo, or for no apparent reason at all. The fight-or-flight system is discussed in more detail later in Chapter 8. Our brain structures, and the chemicals that keep them functioning, also play critical roles in anxiety. The primary inhibitory neurotransmitter in the brain is gamma-aminobutyric acid, GABA, which determines how excited or relaxed we are. Too little GABA leads to anxiety, and too much GABA creates an overly relaxed state. Other important chemicals associated with anxiety are serotonin and norepinephrine. These are the chemicals that are targeted when treating anxiety with medications. The almond-shaped amygdala is a structure in the brain that is responsible for memory, particularly memories that are emotionally charged. When you are confronted with a fearful situation, this small grouping of cells will store the event for future use, whether you want it to or not. The locus coeruleus is another important brain structure related to anxiety. In addition to being involved with sleep, it plays a key role in the development and maintenance of stress and panic. If you find yourself thinking, "He sure didn't have much to say about the neurology of anxiety," it's because I purposely kept it brief. In my experience working with people dealing with anxiety, I generally haven't found them to be all that interested in the topic. But if you are one of those people who'd like more explanation about how the brain contributes to anxiety, you should visit the Brain and Behavior Research Foundation at bbrfoundation.org/anxiety. Environment. There is a great deal of truth to the old saying, "You are a product of your environment." Your early childhood experiences within your family, school, and with friends have as much to do with who you are today as any chemical or part of the brain. Take parenting, for example. Parents who are overly critical, neglectful, rejecting, or too protective can inadvertently create anxiety for their child. Children who grow up in homes where one or both parents have frequent and intense mood swings learn to walk on eggshells so as not to accidentally cause the next outburst. Then there are early experiences outside the home. Children who are repeatedly bullied by other kids learn to view the world as a hostile and dangerous place. Perfectionistic teachers or other authority figures model obsessive behavior and set expectations which often cannot be achieved. And childhood abuse and trauma, which can occur within or outside of the home, can cripple a child emotionally. All these situations carry into adulthood and can lead to lifelong anxiety. Your current environment also contributes to your anxiety. If you're under tight deadlines at work or having money problems, then you are likely anxious. If your relationship is on the rocks, or if you're concerned that you'll never find the right person, then you are likely anxious. If you are dealing with a sick parent or child, then you are likely anxious. I could go on, but my main point is that life continually throws relationship, work, family, and social challenges your way. To varying degrees, each and every one adds to your anxiety. And without a break from the chronic stress, your body and mind will suffer the consequences. Psychology. The psychology of anxiety is relatively simple. How you perceive, interpret, and label people, situations, events, and, well, pretty much everything else, greatly contributes to your anxiety. For example, two mothers get home after a hard day at the office. Both have the same voicemail on their answering machines. "This is Miss Smith, Johnny's teacher from school. Please give me a call when you can. I'd like to talk with you about your son." Knowing that Johnny has been working extra hard at school, the first mother becomes happy and excited. She is convinced that Miss Smith is calling to say how hard Johnny's been working and that his grades are improving. The second mother is immediately overcome with a sense of worry and dread. She believes the only reason Miss Smith could be calling is to tell her that Johnny's grades are getting worse. And if that's not enough, he will have to be held back a grade. As you can see, the same situation elicits two different emotional responses. The only difference is how the mothers interpret the little information available to them. One mother put a positive spin on the message, whereas the other took the negative route. Both outcomes are tied to the way the mothers thought about the situation. But to be fair to the second mother, and to make a point, worry can be adaptive. The second mother's immediate sense of worry also serves as a gentle reminder that Johnny has a tendency to let his grades slip, and that she needs to maintain a constant state of concern and awareness about his progress. A concept related to the previous example is cognitive distortions. Simply put, cognitive distortions are exaggerated thoughts that are often not supported by evidence. They are ways in which we convince ourselves to believe something when it is not necessarily true. They are products of our past experiences, current situations, personality, and probably a bit of biology. And they are generally lifelong patterns of thinking and are very difficult to give up. These distorted thinking patterns are related to how we feel and behave, and many are directly tied to the development and maintenance of anxiety. I discuss cognitive distortions in more detail in Chapter 4. Who is this book for? Everyone deals with stress and anxiety. It's part of our evolutionary and cultural makeup, and at times, we all have periods when our stress and anxiety levels go up. So in that sense, this book is for everyone. What everyone doesn't have is a clear understanding of how, when, and why anxiety becomes problematic. This book will help you gain an awareness of the many techniques available to help manage the more troubling aspects of this normal and ever-present biological, psychological, and sociological phenomenon. This book focuses on anxiety in adults. If you are concerned about a child in your life who may be struggling with anxiety or a related mental health issue, some of the information in this book will be pertinent, and some may not be. For more information on children with anxiety, I recommend How to Find Mental Health Care for Your Child by Ellen Broughton. Likewise, if you are an older adult or are considering buying this book for a friend who is an older adult, you should be aware that various conditions specific to aging and anxiety, for example, retirement from work, memory loss and dementia, physical limitations, loss of peers and loved ones to death, are not covered in the case examples. Consider checking.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?